What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. What's going on, brother?
Chilling, man, as per usual. How about you?
I'm doing pretty well, man. I can't complain. I hope everyone is doing well, and I guess we'll just get started right away. We're recording late right now, so we gotta keep the show moving.
It's a school night, and we've got a bedtime.
Yeah, it's a school night. But yeah, I wanted to give like an update and then go into a more interesting topic that we mentioned last episode. We wanted to talk about Iran and keep that conversation going, specifically about the latest updates. And if you guys have heard, so we last left off with the U.S. saying that they could potentially bring in 120,000 soldiers.
Or more.
Somewhere in the Middle East. We don't know where. That was intended to say, well, 120,000 extra soldiers in the Middle East somewhere. They're going to be a ground force for invading Iran.
Right.
Well, it doesn't seem like that's actually really likely. And the reason why I don't think it's very likely is because I think the most people who are level-headed, I think pretty much everyone who has a straight head on their neck understands that there would be a huge consequence of invading Iran, meaning lots of dead servicemen, which we all don't want, obviously. And now they're kind of playing it off, saying that, well, we're not going to do that anymore. It's going to be, you know, we're going to request 10,000 troops.
There's no more threat. Yeah.
The threat's really not there anymore. And the reason why that threat's not there is because of our tough rhetoric, you know? Like, they back down. So
hard-ass backpedal.
Yeah. You can just kind of tell that it was just a bunch of grandstanding. That's what we said last episode, that it wasn't very likely that there was going to be an invasion, at least a ground invasion in Iran. Because I think everyone knows the risk. Like, people have known the risk for many years. And we live in a Western country, and Western countries cannot stomach casualties.
Nope. No country should stomach casualties.
Well, here's the thing. Countries have a really hard time stomaching casualties when it's a war of choice.
Right.
So when somebody is 5,000 miles away from you and they die in some desert, you're going to be like, what the fuck? Why did 20 Americans die this weekend in some desert?
Right.
I don't even know where this, I don't, I have zero clue what this, you know, this province is. I don't know where this country is. Why did my neighbor's kid just die? It's really hard to justify that when you have like some grand moral mission. I guess they try to do that with Iraq. It's easier to make the case for those casualties, but it's going to be very hard to create that grand moral justification for invading Iran. Like, mm-hmm. What are you going to say? 20,000 American soldiers died because someone who may be connected with Iran blew up a Saudi tank oil tanker. That's why all these people died. So it's like really, it'd be very, very difficult to create that moral justification for a land invasion. So that's why we never thought that would actually happen. And before we get started, and this topic kind of really leads into what we want to discuss. We mentioned this last episode that we wanted to talk about the war games that took place, which can give you kind of a taste of what war in Iran would actually be like. And the war game was called the Millennium Challenge 2002, not the Millennium Falcon.
The MCO2.
First thing I think of in my head is the Millennium Falcon as well. I need to make a correction as well. Last time we spoke, when I referenced this war game, I said it took place 2 years ago. That's not true. I was actually 15 years off the mark. It took place in 2002, hence Millennium Challenge 2002.
Right.
So, I just want to make that correction before we get started, but it's a good segue, into a number of different things that we want to touch on, like potential war, just like how military simulations take place, think different, like, just thinking processes. Why don't you take it and kind of explain what is the Millennium Challenge?
Yeah, so the Millennium Challenge 2002 was originally plotted up and run by the currently defunct U.S. Joint Forces Command, or JFCOM, JIFCOM. And basically what it did was well, first of all, it was the most expensive and ambitious military simulation in American history. This thing was massive. It involved thousands of people, tens of thousands of people. Cost, again, $250 million. But basically, to sum it up, it was the U.S. military against a nameless adversary in the Middle East somewhere. Though it was pretty widely understood that we were talking about Iran, right? Basically, they did a military exercise, a war game, if you will, pitted the two sides against each other, red team versus blue, where red team was the nameless adversary and blue team was us, see what would happen. And I guess the intention was to test out new military strategies and new military technologies, and kind of to prove, prove out, kind of these forward-thinking strategies for the military. Do you have any color for that, Henry? Anything I might have missed?
Yeah, so the U.S. Joint Forces Command, basically, it was focused on military transformation. And what that means is they did things like joint training and experimentation and how to better integrate, military warfighting capabilities. So they handled... I don't want to say think tank type stuff, but they handled just different training exercises, which included, large scale war games like the one that took place in 2002. Another thing I'll add is that, so what the scenario was, it sounds like a Call of Duty game.
Yeah, totally is.
I mean, it basically is a big Call of Duty game that a bunch of generals are playing with each other.
Right.
The exact scenario of what they set up was that a rogue military commander had broken away from his government somewhere in the Persian Gulf, and he was threatening to engulf the entire region of war. And he had a pretty big power base, and he came from a very strong religious and ethnic sect, and he was harboring and sponsoring four different terrorist organizations, and he was highly anti-American. So they were setting up that adversary.
Right. So and that's the plot of the video game.
Yeah, right. That's the plot of the video game. And the way they do it in these war games, or at least the way that the U.S. Joint Forces Command did it, is that they would set up a red team and a blue team.
Right.
And the blue team would always be, U.S. forces or U.S.-backed forces. They would be the good guy. That would be the playable character.
Right.
And then they'd set up a red team as well, which would be
the NPCs,
whoever,
the non-playable characters,
the bad NPC characters, or the terrorist in Counter-Strike, or the Zergs in StarCraft. I don't know, however you want to say it. And they'll just set up different types of objectives.
Yeah.
So, for example, in this war game, the blue team's mission was securing shipping lanes,
right,
like things that we would want to do if we
taking
were in war with
enemy,
Iran.
Enemy weapons capabilities.
Yeah, yeah. Compelling the other country to abandon its goal of regional hegemony, having the government back down. Like that would be in the goals.
Those are the objectives, right?
And in the red team, they would be trying to just, in reality, just preserve the ruling regime, and then reduce the overall presence of the blue forces in that region. So, I mean, pretty straightforward stuff of what you could imagine would be the objectives in a war between the U.S. and Iran. The war planning, this was a pretty big project, as Danny mentioned, 30,000 troops, $250 million, and $250 million is more than some countries spend and having their entire military budget, so
right.
It's a pretty expensive project, and they started planning it back in 2000. Yeah, is there anything I missed right there?
No, I don't think so. I think we should probably set up, like, all right, cool, we got this whole game, we have the scenario, we know what the missions and the objectives are, like, who is playing the game, right? And I think I can take over from here. So the players of it, so it's important to mention that there was also a white cell, right? So it says red team and blue team, but the white cell is basically, like, you know, the dungeon master, right? Every time I think of these war games, I think of, like, you know, a bunch of generals sit down at a table and, like, they're playing Dungeons and Dragons. He's like, oh, I move my tank 50 yards. All right, roll the 20-sided die. That's essentially what's happening here.
Lightning bolt.
Lightning bolt. So the white cell commander was JIFCOM or JFCOM commander Buck Kernan, who has a pretty dope name.
Buck Kernan.
He was pulling the strings. He's the dungeon master. He's the guy that's going to be responsible for setting up the scenario. And also, like, his task was to make sure that we were playing by free play rules, right? And that nobody was bending the rules or doing bullshit like, I don't know, I summon the god of lightning to, you know, to, like, strike down my enemies or some weird shit. So that was him. So then on the red team, we've got retired Marine Corps 3-star general Paul Van Riper, and he's an absolute badass. He had been retired for like 2 to 5 years or something like that from the military, and then they brought him on because of his previous engagements in previous war games. We can talk a little bit more about that later. And then finally, on the blue team, commanding the good guys is Army Lieutenant General B.B. Bell. For the blue team, and those were the players.
Do you want to play a game? I have a stick of dynamite attached to your testicles. Now answer this riddle and this complex math problem, and think about all the times that you masturbated. So I guess let's like go into. Let's go into kind of like what the blue team was doing, because that's really interesting.
Yeah, like how it was conducted, I think, is also important too.
How it was conducted and what they were hoping to accomplish with that. I think going in, the blue team had very specific goals. The U.S. had very specific goals in mind. Mm-hmm. And I think they were going through some confirmation bias as well. They were trying to prove... They were coming to a realization, the Pentagon at least was, that the old days of tank battles and...
Trench warfare
yeah. and rushing the battlefield with Sherman tanks.
Or like these long, drawn-out, like, drudge wars. Like, that was over. Yeah.
They were coming to that realization that that wasn't really going to happen. Mainly because there was not a single military on the face of the earth that could go toe-to-toe with the U.S. war machine. Like, right. It would just be impossible. So they came to that realization that a war in the future was going to be most likely something like an insurgency. The war would be a war on like the societal habits of a country to change them almost. Like yeah. it would be a lot more complex than just, you know, winning a battle or two. So basically they were doing a lot of probability stuff. So they were trying to predict. They had like a decision making map, you know, if the enemy does this, then we'll do that. If the enemy does this, it will do that. And it will evaluate things on like different levels, not just military wise. It evaluated things on a social level, on an economic level, as on a political level, and of course the military level as well. But it combined all those different methods together to come up with like the perfect solution. So mm-hmm. It was like highly computerized. They wanted to see if this type of prediction algorithm would be able to lift the fog of war. Let's go into like the actual. Like what actually happened with this?
Yeah, I think that's. And I definitely want to touch on one point just to add a little color there. So, the war exercise was mostly computer simulation, right? So a general would tell, you know, the white cell, the middle team, we're doing X, and then they would crunch the numbers and they would get an output out of it. But a big portion of this was this giant live fire exercise where they actually moved. Human beings around areas to do these maneuvers to, like I said, like you said before, prove out whether or not these new strategies would be viable, right? And that was only planned for a little bit later in the game. The early stages of this, and Henry, I know you had a really good line on this one. The early stage of the game was just like, get there, control some shipping lanes, and like move quickly. And this, and that's where it, you know, the whole game got flipped on its head. But it's really important to talk about that live fire exercise, because this is what was mandated by Congress, right? They were like, you need to go out and do some real stuff to figure out how effective and how lethal our forces are, and gain knowledge so that we can be better at war, right? So this was like, that was the big, big point on it. Now, Henry, you want to walk us through like what day one looked like and how it got kicked off and started?
So they parked an aircraft carrier battle group right offshore the Red Team's country, so fictional Iran, and they issued Red Team an 8-point ultimatum, of which the final point was to surrender. And Van Riper, he knew that his country's political leadership, they wouldn't be able to accept this, and he believed that blue forces were going to, they were going to directly intervene, and they were going to also preemptively strike.
Right, and that's a part of that Bush doctrine, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Of jumping out and do these preemptive strikes as a defensive measure to like an immediate or perceived future threat to the security of the U.S.
Exactly. So he figured that they were going to strike first, though in his head already, it's like, I'm going to have to probably strike first in order to get a shot off, because we'll just be annihilated if we don't. So what the blue team does is they don't surrender, obviously. So the blue team, they knock out their microwave towers and they cut their fiber optic lines. And the reason why they did that is because they're trying to force them
to use radio.
They want to monitor satellites and cell phone communication and things like that. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to force them to engage in a communication process that the U.S. could heavily monitor. And that's because their prediction chart, that's what they told them what to do. And what Van Riper does, which is very interesting, is that he is just like, okay, like I figured that was going to happen. And he started using motorcycles couriers and
motorcycle couriers, right?
So motorcycle couriers and to communicate messages. So he didn't fall into that trap. He didn't use cell phones or use that. He was still able to communicate.
It gets really interesting too, because like in addition to these, like literally sending people on motorcycles to send messages around the country on what to do, he also started doing some pretty interesting things. So in the Muslim faith, there is a thing called the Adhan or Azan. I'm probably butchering this. Sorry for our Arabic listeners out there. It's basically like five times a day on a loudspeaker, they'll like say a prayer, right? And they'll broadcast this out loud. And this is very common among Muslim nations, but they were hiding coded messages in them on when to strike. And since this happens five times a day, this is a pretty regular mode of communication, right? And another one that I picked up on was they were basically hiding coded messages in the light patterns on their airfield airstrips, right? So like they would change the pattern of the airstrips to indicate what to do and when to do it. So Van Riper was really, really clever, you know, in his method of like how to get around the issue of, okay, I can't use fiber optic, I can't use regular, you know, encrypted modes of communication. I have to figure something out that won't give away my position or what I'm about to do. And I think that's pretty incredible of him to think of.
But when you think about it, though, it's like, yeah, it's intuitive and it's resourceful. But if he's able to think of that, then he's not the only person who'd be able to think.
Yeah,
of that,
I mean, he's not like the only genius that can figure it out, right?
I mean, it doesn't even take genius level ability to do that. I mean, yeah, I'm not trying to take a hit at him right now. It's very resourceful, and he's a great general. And I've listened to Paul Van Riper's other stuff. Like he's a very smart, educated guy, and he's definitely an academic as far as generals go. A lot of those, I feel like a lot of those Vietnam era officers, a lot of them were, you know, if they weren't academics at the time, they became academics. Because there was so much analysis after the Vietnam War of what went wrong. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of generals and officers at that time took a very academic approach to like figuring out like new ways in war to make it better.
Right.
So this guy was definitely a student. I know he came, he was a historian as well. So, you know, smarter than your average cookie, obviously. But like, I don't think that those unique instincts would be, lost on an Iranian commander. Just like think about this. Iran has been dealing with crazy sanctions for decades at this right. point. They went through a catastrophic war.
Regime changes, all the
they've
dirty
gone
tricks.
Through a lot of really bad things. So I would imagine that their population and their military corps, and they have a good military. Mm-hmm. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard, by all means, is very elite as far as Middle Eastern military units. So I would think that someone would be able to think of something like that, and right. they have a plan like that.
Right.
If he's able to think of it, I'm sure the Iranians would be able to think of the same thing. So, yeah.
On that note, though, so like what happens was, you know, the U.S. goes in, blue team goes in, and they're like, hey, we got this on lock. We cut their communication. We sent out our 8-point ultimatum on them. We've got this in the bag. All we got to do is, like, you know, hit them hard and land our troops and then take over the country. But Van Riper's smarter than that. So dude basically crunched the numbers and figured out how many so these military vessels, like the carrier groups, have these Aegis anti-missile, anti-rocket, like auto cannons, right? And they're pretty incredible, right? They have the ability to track and shoot down out of the sky missiles that come at them, and it's really, really effective. However, there is an upwards limit to how many rockets these things can take, right? And they crunched the numbers, they did some data, and they figured out we know exactly how many we think they can take, and they launched more. So as soon as the blue team crossed that like point of no return where they couldn't back out and retreat, Van Riper unleashes a huge barrage of missiles from ground-based launchers that they already had, but also they hid them in commercial ships. They flew airplanes at them, but they were flying them super low, and airplanes that didn't have like radio comms to like so that they wouldn't get caught by radio like radar. And also, this is the craziest part: he would load a ton of like small boats, fast moving boats, with explosives, like, and just do straight up suicide missions. Right? They would run up on the ships and just blow themselves up, like, to hell with it all. And it was effective. So basically, they got overwhelmed, the carrier group, and Van Riper was able to sink 19 U.S. ships, including the carrier, several, like, a bunch of cruisers, and some other ships as well. And by Van Riper's own accounts, he said it was over in like 10 minutes.
So remember that this is just like kind of like the political thought. He knew that the U.S. would preemptively strike.
Right.
So
he wanted to hit them
first.
Or
the blue team would preemptively strike. Right. So he was like, I need to get the first shot. So when he sent out, like the second day, it led off with a small fleet of boats in the Persian Gulf. And they were initially there just to track the ships. However, they just fired without any type of warning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just fired and they just attacked without warning, and it resulted in 19 U.S. ships were sunk.
It was massive. It was massive.
Yeah, including a carrier, cruisers, 5 and amphibious ships. And the whole thing was over in 5 minutes. And when that happened, the response was like, you know how if you play pool, and let's just say you pay $5 to play pool at a bar.
Right.
Because it's always ridiculously expensive to play pool at a bar.
Right.
Or maybe it's just bars that I go to because I live in Manhattan where they try to, like, screw you everywhere you go. But if you knock in your 8-ball on your first turn, most likely you're going to just pretend like the eight ball, it didn't happen or something like that, or catch the eight ball, put the eight ball back on the table, or do something so you can continue playing because you just paid $5 for it.
Right.
So that was the response of the of the blue team.
Yeah,
basically.
It was ridiculous.
They respond to everything. So they just, you know, they're just like, oh, resurrection. Resurrection power.
Yeah, they just respawned like it was a video game. But what was crazy, though, was that Bell, I mean, this is where it starts getting really controversial and weird. If you remember earlier on, I mentioned that, you know, the live fire, like, forcible entry part, which was arguably probably the most expensive part of this whole thing that, like, mobilized thousands of people to do a live fire exercise. Like, they had to do that part, you know? The fact that Van Riper got this giant early win, like, could not stop the fact that they had to redo it. So, you know, maybe you want to give them some credit and be like, hey, we already paid for this, we got to do it, you know, whatever. Like you said, I already put my $5 down on the table, like, let's put the eight ball back on the table so that we can keep playing and see what happens, right? That's one thing. But, like, Bell basically just asked, you know, Kernan, like, hey, can you just respawn my ships real quick, dude? All right, cool.
Yeah.
So they hit the reset button and they kept going, and they learned about the, you know, like Van Riper's playing style from it, right? They were like, okay, this dude's crazy, and he's going to do some ridiculous shit, so, you know, we have to play by a different game. And then what happened was, you know, Kernan started changing the rules, like, middle of the game. So he was like, all right, you can't do that anymore, you're acting out of character. And it really kicked off when we were doing the live fire exercises when we've got these V-22 Ospreys, right? And these were brand new planes. I don't even think that they were being used at the time, but they were bought and paid for in development, and they were like, all right, we're going to use them. Now, hopefully we can throw up a picture on the screen of what a V-22 Osprey is, but it's basically like a helicopter airplane thing, right? And you got the wings, and the wings go up like this, and they got two giant propellers on them, and then it'll vertically take off. They're troop carriers, right? And then they put them forward to fly forward. It's a badass plane, but Van Riper knew that they were going to use them. And these things have giant, like, radar cross-section, you know, because they're not stealth vehicles at all, right? They're enormous. They're awesome vehicles, but they you can find them even with, like, really rudimentary and crude radar systems. So Kernan was like, guess what? You can't use radar. You can't do that. And then he said, you also can't fire on the V-22s while they're doing the live drop, right? When they drop the troops off, which is absolutely ridiculous. Like, if we have these giant flying targets that are easily identified on radar, even if you can't use them on radar, like, you can see them, right? So if we had ground troops, you can probably fire on them. They couldn't fire on them. And then Van Riper was like, all right, well, if I can't use radar to shoot them from far and I can't shoot them at all, can I use chemical weapons on the ground when the people hit the ground? And they denied him that too, because he had access to those chemical weapons. Those were, you know, in his arsenal, but they were like, nah, you can't do that. So at this point, this is a botched experiment. This isn't a real game. Like, we're playing with cheat codes now. Blue team's playing with cheat codes.
Yeah, and it's just ridiculous that you do that, because obviously you want to. So that the most productive part of that entire operation to me is the first 5 minutes of it on the first 5 minutes of day two,
right?
When red team blows up an entire battle group, 19 ships, and kills 20,000 servicemen. That was the casualty rate on those 20,000 ships.
Right. It was insane.
That's the most productive part of that entire operation, because now you have the knowledge of dealing with an unpredictable enemy. And what makes it even better is that you know that your matrix chart, your algorithm that you're using to predict everything that's going to happen in the future, that it doesn't really hold water.
It doesn't, yeah.
When you're actually in the battlefield, like a very famous quote from Mike Tyson,
I know this one, yeah.
It's like, everyone has a plan until you get punched in the mouth.
That's right.
Like, well, that's
that's what happened to Blue Team. Yeah, exactly. It, they got punched in the face.
So a lot of this information that I'm getting it from, I know Danny and I are both, we did our research from different sources. I did most of my research on this topic from Malcolm Gladwell, and he wrote this really good book called Blink, and it's all about like decision making processes and things like that. I would recommend it if you're into psychology and things like that. But he has a whole chapter dedicated to this, and he goes into really good detail. Where he was coming in at on this topic was that sometimes short, spontaneous decisions that are based off instinct are better than decisions that are highly calculated. And it's very, very difficult to predict humans. I think that's true. Obviously, there's a time and place for those type of, you want to take calculated risk and you want to have the data to back yourself up. But if you rely on it so much, it's just impossible. It's impossible. Like, how many different chess? Like, if there's two people playing chess, how many different chess moves can they make on their first round?
I don't actually know that number.
The probability is just so outlandish that they would be playing until the end, until the sun blows up or something like that. It's something just like, it's way higher than you would expect. So I think that you need that firsthand experience, and you need to, just because your algorithm says that, you know, this political leader or this rogue commander will do this based off this economic decision, and it's just based off the computer. I just think that's a lousy way to do it.
And the insane part about it was, like, even though they were using these algorithms and things like that to predict stuff, like, they were using some pretty heavy-handed assumptions too, right? So some of the assumptions that they were using were, like, for example, the V-22 Osprey, they weren't even in service. We didn't even have those, right? They didn't have... Like, they were talking about using, like, air-based lasers that we didn't even have. They were talking about using, like, high intelligence, like... Jesus. I wrote this down somewhere and I totally forgot. But basically, like, intelligence from radar and satellite, like, jointly put together. Just stuff that we didn't even have, frankly. The assumptions that we were making was insane. We were definitely, like, again, we were playing with cheat codes. It didn't make any sense.
It didn't make any sense, and it just shows you something. I think it's like, it illustrates a presumption that military technology is always going to give you the advantage in a military engagement no matter what.
Right.
I don't necessarily think that's the case. I don't think that it necessarily wins you a war. I think what it does is it saves people's lives.
Sure.
I think that's true. It saves people on whoever has a better technology's team. It saves a lot of lives. Like, most likely, without that technology, you're dealing with a lot more casualties. But it doesn't mean you're going to win the war. And it's been there's been different case studies. I think the best case study is Afghanistan or Vietnam. I think Afghanistan is great because, like, dude, there's a bigger insurgency in Afghanistan now than there was when we went there.
Right.
So the U.S. didn't win anything. And they have far superior technology, far better training, far better everything.
But it became a war of attrition at that point, you know.
At the end of the day, you know, most U.S. soldiers, the only land they controlled was a land that they stood on, you know? So it's hard to prepare for things like that, especially when you're going to be fighting an enemy on their home turf who's going to be desperate. Like, you don't think that if someone invaded your country, you would fight to the death to defend your country, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we take it a step further, like, we can pretend like aliens are invading, you know, the Earth, right? We would do everything in our power to stop that from happening. We would do some crazy shit.
Like, who's the guy from Independence Day?
Will Smith.
Not Will Smith. Who was also in the Vacation movies?
That was the dad of the president.
It wasn't the dad of the president. It was the... I forget the actor's name.
All right, forget it. What about him?
So he... he flies into the alien ship to destroy it.
Right, well, he did that with Will Smith.
No, Will Smith wasn't in the ship with him. It was his own. It was like a different plane battle.
Oh, when he sacrifices his own life?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you would do that sort of stuff if you were being occupied by some galactic Xenu type
exactly,
character.
Which kind of points out like those speedboats with explosives and like the kamikaze shit. Like, yeah, they would do that.
Randy Quaid.
Randy Quaid.
That's the actor's name. I did a quick search on that.
So important.
If you have the sources and the material, you should be able to use it, you know, even in a simulation. But then again, this took place in 2002, so it was a long time ago. But, I mean, do you know anything about the consequences of this? Like, what? I know Van Riper was pissed off.
Yeah, I mean, he quit, by the way. 6 days in, he was like, oh, fuck this shit. Like, this is not real. But he stayed on as, like, an advisor for the remainder of the 17 days. But he basically said, like, this isn't real. Like, we're not... This isn't free play, like they said. It wasn't an honest exercise. And, you know, they keep changing the rules of engagement, middle of the game. Like, this isn't helpful, you know? We're not learning anything out of this. And I kind of agree. Like, so on the one hand, when Van Riper struck them in the beginning and, you know, they sunk 19 ships, like, I get why they would want to reset the ships, right? Because they did have this whole, like, planned thing to do the live fire exercise. And I get that.
I'm honestly
part.
I'm fine with that. Yeah. Honestly, because they're not gonna get in reality.
Stop. Like go, if, game over.
No, but if that actually happened, most likely the US is not gonna continue with its plan. Like
it's not gonna
go ahead with the ground invasion after losing an entire fleet and having 20,000 people die. It would be a huge catastrophe.
Right.
And the US would have to whatever military would have to regroup. So yeah, you plan this $250 million war game. Obviously, you're going to want to get your money's worth,
right? So I mean, I get it. Just for the learnings, right? Okay, cool. We lost that first one, but let's just see if we hadn't lost it, right? How would we conduct this like live fire, like storm the beaches of Normandy type operation, right? But when they decided, like, okay, cool, you can't shoot our airplanes, you can't use no chemical weapons, you can't like use radar, you can't use anything. We're just going to storm it like. You know, that's it. It's like, no, dude, like, no. We're not going to learn anything from that. You know? Like...
Yeah, and just, like, the handicaps is, like, the big thing.
Yeah.
That's really... Like, I understand the refloating the ships thing. Like, that makes sense, obviously. Like, but the... Putting handicaps, I think, was dumb. But it just goes to show you anything can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And... Van Riper was very pissed. I've heard interviews with him. He basically said that, like, the level of a lot of this was just for bureaucratic reasons. There was political reasons.
He said validating a concept that had failed, basically.
Yeah, they were trying to validate a concept that had failed.
It's a lot like the episode that we did on the Bradley armored fighting vehicle. You know. Like, same idea, where they were fixing all of the live fire tests and saying, like, oh, no, this is totally fine. We're going to completely empty the gas tank when we shoot a rocket out of it so that it won't blow up, you know? Or we're going to put sand in the bullets instead of, like, explosive, like, actual bullet gunpowder and stuff so that they don't explode, you know? And it wasn't until someone decided, like, hey, let's do a for realsies live fire exercise that they exposed all of the vulnerabilities of the program, and then they had to make updates to it.
I'll say this. He did say that was probably one of the worst cases of that going on. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I don't know if that's happened anymore. That's obviously the most famous, mainly because of just, like, the striking numbers involved with it.
Right.
Like, the 20,000 servicemen in the fleet that was destroyed.
Right.
But you have to think, like, that type of thinking. There's been simulations about a potential invasion in the Persian Gulf, because I know the country was obviously anonymous, but it was Iran.
Right.
You know?
Well, I mean, like, so the report came out on it. So how it ended was obviously Blue Team won, right? Like, they won. They mission success, right? And obviously Van Riper's pissed off about it, and he was like writing to a couple people about like how he was worried that, you know, some of this stuff was going to leak, that and it did leak to the media, and then JFCOM got mad at him for, you know, speaking disparagingly about it, and tried to like backpedal and be like, no, it was totally fine, like we won, all the things that we set out to prove, we proved. But then 10 years later, like, the actual report came out. It was not public for a long time, so that got released 10 years after, in 2012. And it was 752 pages long, and it talked about how, yeah, we got caught off guard, and a big reason why was because we were using old playbooks, you know, old playbooks that other people knew about, definitely Van Riper knew about. And, you know, the reason why we were perceived to be the winner was because we had advanced technology that we didn't even have, but also because we're just a better military. And so it was a little bit stacked. And they go so far as to say that, you know, in that report, I'm going to read this because I lifted this directly from it. So, as the exercise progressed, the Op 4 free play was eventually constrained to the point where the end state was scripted. The scripting ensured a blue team operational victory and established conditions in the exercise for transition operations. Right? So they basically admitted, like, all right, yeah, we fudged this one. And I hope that, I mean, and we've been doing military exercises since. I mean, we do them all the time, you know, like we did live fire training not too long ago in near the DMZ to train for the threat of North Korea. I hope that we learned a lot from this and that we conduct more realistic war games and like learn a thing or two, because like the stakes are high, right? This is like human beings' lives could be lost if we're messing around doing fake trainings, you know.
If that's a standard practice, and I don't think it is, I don't think that's like the standard MO of people who are doing war games, right? Like to make unrealistic situations like that. Obviously, they know that their job's on the line, and the line of a lot of soldiers are on the line,
right,
for doing things like that on a consistent basis. But at the very least, the information is out there. It is a famous story. It's not that much. It's not, people don't talk about it that much. I mean, I,
which is surprising,
obviously. Yeah. I obviously didn't know that much about it because I totally I got the year wrong in the last podcast.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting case, and I think it is a fun topic to cover because there's a lot of different discussion points. There's a lot of different bullet points to dive into, which we let off the podcast with. I think the most pressing one is just like the consequence of getting into a war in the Persian Gulf.
That's right. How difficult it
doesn't
would be.
Seem. It doesn't seem like it's going to be very easy to do that. And even if that doesn't take place, like I mean, obviously, it seems like Van Riper, you know, played his cards very, very well. Maybe there isn't a Persian military commander who's going to be able to do that, but there's going to be some casualties. There's going to be, even if it's not 20,000, like I highly doubt there'd be 20,000 casualties on the first day.
In the first 10 minutes, yeah.
I don't think the U.S. would ever put themselves in a position to lose 20,000 soldiers.
Yeah, definitely not after
in
that.
The first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I think that would be just, I couldn't even imagine the U.S. military putting,
right, that's crazier
that
than 9/11 and Pearl Harbor put together. Yeah,
yeah, I wouldn't be able to imagine getting into a situation like that, or at least the U.S. military getting into a situation like those are like World War One casualty numbers.
Yeah.
Like when the British and the French and the Germans were losing, they had 20,000 casualties a day.
Mm-hmm.
That would just be crazy. But yeah, that's why I thought, like, with this context, I think it's important. I don't think any U.S. president is nuts, is crazy enough. The Pentagon obviously doesn't want to do this. They just really want to, they just want to, like, talk tough and be like, oh, let's get aggressive with Iran. Let's stick our chest out. And they understand that if they would follow through with some type of military intervention, then it would probably be bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to you before we started recording this. I have kind of like a weird theory. I don't know if it's weird, but it's kind of a bro history type thing or bro geopolitics type thing. I speculate that a lot of the, at least this is how I kind of think Trump thinks. It's impossible to really tell how Trump thinks, but I kind of have an I feel like I have kind of a grasp of how he thinks. He's the type of guy who thinks, who's always thinking about deals, 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 deals. I just want to make deals. I really do think Trump's instincts tell him not to get into a military conflict, not to engage in a war, or at least a war of choice. And he would definitely prefer not to do it, because every single time that he's had tough rhetoric somewhere, he puts his foot in his mouth, or there's some type of, I mean, believe it or not, you could say even progress on the other side I don't want to say due to his rhetoric, but
I mean, like Little Rocket Man, and then they have a
yeah. I don't want to say that Little Rocket Man. I don't want to give him the credit saying Little Rocket Man made
any headway on there. Yeah,
I think that Kim Jong Un and North Korea were looking for.
Yeah, they were already the pieces were in play already, and Moon Jae-in from South Korea had been doing a lot of the legwork already.
Yeah, they. I think the main thing is that North Korea was already looking for sanction relief.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that Trump, I'll get to my point, that Trump wants to make a scenario or put other countries in a position where if they trade with Iran, then the U.S. will have leverage because they'll be able to penalize them economically.
Mm-hmm.
If they do business with Iran. So they want to have Iran as a boogeyman because they know that a lot of countries in Asia – I mean, I'm really just pointing out China.
China
gets about 10% of their oil from Iran, or
right.
Iran
do business,
sells
right.
about 50% of their oil to China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
I mean,
most likely China's
going to
do it
anyway. It's all related to these trade wars, right? You know, and even Iran has said, like sanctions or not, we'll find a way to sell our oil. Like, it's going to happen. So,
yeah, they're going to find a way. You just create black markets when you make things illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that I think this is kind of related to China in some aspect that Trump wants some type of leverage on China if they do business with Iran, because he probably figures, or maybe he doesn't figure this. Maybe I'm giving him too much credit. I never know.
He doesn't think at all, and he's just like going off the cuff for whatever.
You know what? I'm not today. I saw something on Fox about Iran. He sees a special on the Iranian Revolution. You know what? Let's just sanction him. Okay.
Nancy Pelosi says something to the effect of, like, he's obstructing justice. And he's like, oh, no, I got to take the heat off me for a second. We're gonna talk tough about Iran.
I support Nancy Pelosi. She's a great leader. Okay. Pocahontas. I can't wait till we find out who's...
I know.
Until the campaign trail,
I know, dude. It's like
up.
It's like Game of Thrones is over, and now I can't wait till the next season of Who Wants to Be a President? America's best top Democrat.
it's gonna be
great.
It's gonna be a load of like very very stupid television.
Oh, dude, it's my favorite reality TV show is political debates for the presidency. On
well,
both sides, frankly, on both sides, it's so interesting.
The Republican debates were so much more entertaining than Democratic.
Well,
because
they said the most ridiculous shit. They said the most ridiculous shit
because they had Trump.
I mean, even before Trump, you remember Herman Cain during the previous election, and is like 999. I'm gonna make a flat tax rate 999. It's just like my pizza business 999. Like they would say some bad shit. Weird stuff.
But yeah, but Trump just the interactions between Trump and guys like Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio was just ridiculous, because all those guys have giant sticks up their asses and Trump is just, you know what? Marco's short. Like, that would be his response.
Exactly.
Hey, Marco's short.
Jeb's got low energy.
Yeah, look at that, Jeb.
When he said the Rams, dead.
The beginning of one of the, I forget which debate it was, but the first thing he said is like, before I answer your question, I just want to say, why is Rand Paul on the stage? No one's going to actually vote for him. He has no chance.
Just throwing shade. That's all it is.
My favorite part of the entire election was when, the second debate, somebody asked him about releasing his taxes, his tax return.
I'm under audit. I can't do it.
And he said, the guy who asked the question was like, Donald Trump, when you were on my show, you said that you would release your tax returns. And he said, and Trump responded, he's like, well, first of all, nobody watches your show.
Sick it's burn, like, bro.
First of all, no one watches your show. Lowest ratings ever. And at that time, we're just like, I don't even care what he says next. Love him or hate him, there's one thing you have to admit about Donald Trump. You can't stop watching him.
Yeah, it's like a train wreck, man.
It's just like, this guy is so entertaining. This guy's a star. He's a star.
He's entertaining in all the worst possible ways.
He's also hilarious. I give credit. My favorite, I always find myself liking Trump when he does something funny. Like, I have to admit, like, when he called Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas, I thought that was incredible. And when he said the Trail of Tears, and that he had that Trail of Tears tweet, those are the type of things that I'm like,
cringeworthy.
This is great.
I mean like all the political comedians give him credit too. It's like, you can't make this shit up. Like, this isn't even a funny like late night TV show joke. Like, he just throws it out for them. It's like, he's not leaving any good material for, you know, all the actual comedians.
But those things that he does that people find inappropriate on a social level, those are the things that I find redeeming about Donald Trump. And then it's like the policy I try to focus on, and I try to, like, when I have a criticism on Donald Trump, I usually focus on what I disagree with, what he's doing as president. I try not to focus on like the dumb stuff, like the stuff that I find funny. I don't really like to. I think it's like that's what the media focuses on.
They should focus on the policy, and I do focus on the policy too. It's just, I don't think that the things that he does is funny. So it's just like compounding to like my hatred of this person.
Yeah, I guess that's a fair point.
It's like, your policy shit and you're an asshole. I don't like anything about you. You know?
I mean, that's a fair point if you don't find him funny, but
sometimes. As long as he does say some shit that's pretty funny, but like.
If you have to admit, there's moments when you're just like, oh, God, I wish I liked... It's like, and I know people on the left think this too. It's like, I really wish I didn't hate him.
So I just started Twitter, right? You know, I just jumped on there, you know, at.
Yeah, Danny's on Twitter now.
Abdel, Abdel. So follow me. Tweeting that fire. Anyway, so I'm like looking at, you know, who should I follow, you know, because I want to make commentary on, you know, your usual basics, right? So I followed all the people on the left, you know, all the Democratic runners. So, like, I have, like, 1,000 new follows. Like, I'm following 1,000 people now because that's how big the Democratic field is. Just because I want to see what they're talking about and what they're doing. And then, obviously, Donald Trump comes up as, like, a suggestion. And I'm like, do I follow him? Because, like, you know he's going to say some shit that I'm going to want to say something about. But at the same time, do I want to give him the satisfaction of a real human being follower? See, it's like a...
What does he have, 70 million followers? Yeah, like, I don't think he'll heart will be broken. Yeah, but if you don't get his follow.
At least like 50 million of them are like Russian bots anyway, so...
No, it's 50 million everyone is following him. I doubt that it's that many Russian bots.
No, I'm joking, obviously. But he did lose a fuck ton of followers because Twitter cracked down on a bunch of Russian bot accounts. So there's that. But anyway, that was the dilemma that I had earlier this week when I was like, do I follow him or not? I wonder if there's like a like someone who retweets all of Donald Trump's tweets that I can follow instead of following Donald Trump.
Every journalist ever does that?
Yeah. All right, cool. So I guess I don't have to then.
All right, what are we at right now? All right, we're probably over an hour. Yeah. I think we've been on for about an hour and 20. I'm not sure what the recording is right now, but everyone, thank you so much for joining today. I hope you guys got a lot of the conversation. If you guys are still listening, make sure that you rate and review the podcast. If you're on Apple Podcast, if you're on iTunes or listening on an Apple device, it really helps our show grow. I've been seeing a lot of reviews come in lately, so I really do appreciate it. So rate and review. It is it really does help us grow the show. If you really like us, you want to support the show further, we do have a Patreon account where we release like extended podcast as well as our archive selection as well. So the link's in the description below. And Danny, anything you want to add? You want to plug your Twitter again?
Yeah, so that's @Danny_Abdel, ABDEL. Hit me up.